Iowa Land and Sky is a visual love letter to the Iowa landscape. The Happiness Machine is a documentary about finding happiness by living a simple life in rural Iowa. Both premiere this week on Iowa Public Television. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll preview these two new documentaries airing on Iowa Public Television. But first, 11 different sites that played an important role in African-American history in Iowa are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But the State Historic Preservation Office is hoping that Iowans can help put other spots important in the civil rights movement on the map. I'll talk with Paula Moore of the State Historical Society and Betty Andrews from the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP chapter. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll preview two new documentaries premiering on Iowa Public Television this week. But first, 11 different sites that played an important role in African-American history in Iowa are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But the State Historic Preservation Office is hoping that Iowans can help put other spots important to the civil rights movement on the map. Homes, businesses, churches, and other places. This is the 20th Century Civil Rights Survey Project. And with me to talk about the project and some of the important historic sites in Iowa, Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP chapter and CEO of Betty Andrews Media. Hello, Betty.
Hi, Charity. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Also with us, Paula Moore, architectural historian at the State Historical Society of Iowa. Hello, Paula.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me here.
Well, thanks for being here also. And let's start with sort of an overview of this 20th Century Civil Rights Survey Project. And Paula, I'll let you tell us a little bit about it. What's the idea behind the project?
Well, the idea is to do a physical survey of the state, looking for properties that still stand that can help us tell the story of the civil rights movement in Iowa during the 20th century. So we'll be looking at homes of people who played a pivotal role in the movement. Churches are a great place where to look where some of these movements got their grounding on a local level. And then schools where there was tension. And so those are some of the sites that we'll be looking at as part of this project. The other aspect of it will be to lay out what we call a historical context for the civil rights movement. So this will be a discussion of the pivotal events, the people who played a role in this movement, and the places where these events took place. That will be a survey report. And then we'll also be nominating at least one property to the National Register of Historic Places. We have a couple of other outreach activities as well, like a website where we'll have a civil rights tour. And we have a culture app that people can download to their smartphone, and there will be a map of civil rights sites on that site as well.
So there'll be a dedicated civil rights tour on that app, which the app, if you don't already have it, you should download it because it has so many historic and cultural places throughout the state of Iowa already. But so you could take a tour of these sites and learn more about them is the idea?
Yes, that's right. So you would be able to pick a category called civil rights movement, and then all those sites would be mapped out on a map of the state of Iowa, and you would be able to drive the state and see and learn more about this history.
And you will be asking individuals all over the state and individuals who've been in the state in the past to nominate sites, right?
That's right. In fact, that effort is already underway. We've established a website at the State Historical Society where people can go on and provide us with information about sites that deserve some further research. And so we've already gotten a lot of nominations from people around the state.
That's exciting. And of course, you can call in this hour and share the sites that you might be nominating, the stories that you'd like to share at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Betty, why do you think this project is so important?
You know, there are so many places and activities in Iowa that have really changed the outcome of lives for many people in Iowa. And so this key piece about it being related to civil rights is extremely important. I come to you fresh off of a day on the Iowa Capitol Hill in which we were speaking with the governor about creating a criminal justice reform committee. And it takes people and it takes places to make change. And it takes people who are interested and understand that history is important. Not only is history important, but quality of life is important and the well-being of people is important. So this civil rights piece is an effort to memorialize many leaders from across the state who have taken it upon themselves to make things better for not only people in minority communities, but Iowa as a whole. So documenting these places and people, which obviously the places are extremely important, but the reason that they are important is because there were actions by good people in these places. So, you know, one of the things that we don't want to do is forget, because, you know, if you forget your past, history will repeat itself. And so being able to document these places and share that documentation through all of the efforts that Paula mentioned are hugely important for progressing Iowa.
Well, and so many of us grew up and learned a little bit about the civil rights movement when we were in school. And so much of the education about the civil rights movement focused on things that happened far away from
Absolutely.
Iowa. I mean, do you feel like a lot of Iowans don't really have an understanding that this was happening right here and Iowans were involved and affected? Do you think that that's something we've overlooked over the years?
You know what? It is something that we have taken a look at, and I, in another role that I play as a director of a project called I'll Make Me a World in Iowa, because of that very thing, we created a project called the Black History Game Show, in which we bring this information and we have a game show that it talks about civil rights and Black history events, but then we have a specific chapter that is dedicated to Iowa, because that is one of the things we want to leave our students with, that not only is this history and are these events that affect everyone's life happening across the country, they are happening in our state. And not only that, a lot of the national movements, it's so, you know, it's amazing to find that so many of those movements, Iowa actually was ahead of the curve on a number of those movements. One of the senators that I met with yesterday was from Muscatine, Iowa. And that is the place where Alexander Clark and his daughter sued and gained admittance into school, and they desegregated schools there. So things like that, and that was way before Brown versus the Board of Education. So there are different sites that showcase those things, and it's so great. My only sad point on this piece is that there were so many sites that were destroyed.
Right.
And that are no longer there, that, I mean, we certainly can talk about, and we talk about that with that Black History Game Show piece that we discussed. But That there are so many opportunities that are missed, but we appreciate that this project is going to capture those that are related to brick and mortar that are still standing. And, you know, this is really exciting for us.
Well, and maybe even lead to the preservation of some of these sites as well. I mean, Paula, that has to be part of the hope, right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that is one of the primary goals of the project. There's a basic principle in historic preservation that you can't preserve what you don't know exists. And so in my field of historic preservation, we put a lot of emphasis on doing survey to identify properties and then to document their history so that we understand why they're significant. And until you go through that process in a comprehensive way, and that's the purpose of this project, is to look statewide, it's really hard for us to establish preservation priorities and make sure that important buildings can receive some financial incentives in the form of grants or historic tax credits that could really do a lot to preserve them and make sure that they stand for future generations to appreciate.
When somebody makes a nomination, what kind of information do they need to have to get this considered?
Well, some very basic information is useful to us, like a street address, because that then becomes a springboard for all sorts of other research that we can do through census records, city directories, Sanborn fire insurance maps that will help us understand the property better. But if there are historic photographs or any sort of history that the person knows about the property, we certainly would want to hear that as well.
All right. And I want to talk about some of the sites that are on that list already, the 11 sites that have that National Register of Historic Places demarcation, but also some of the sites that are under consideration. And you've both come up with a list of some of the sites that you want to talk about. Again, we invite you to call us and share your nominations and the places that are important to you. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Betty, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the Edna Griffin Building in Des Moines.
Absolutely. This, you know, Edna Griffin was a civil rights leader, had a lot of spunk, and one of the things that she is well known for is the desegregation of Katz Diner, and actually making it so that public accommodations would allow for anyone to be served in a restaurant or diner or retail business. And so she and her husband moved to Iowa, and she went to the diner for service and was rejected. She worked with the NAACP and a number of other individuals. They protested, didn't get results. They were thrown out of the diner, and she actually sued on the basis of public accommodations and was successful in that suit to the tune of $1. But that $1, you know, the cash amount certainly wasn't as important as the historical significance.
Right.
That's the fact that she sat in well before some of the lunch counter sit-ins nationally and was able to make that change here in Iowa.
And we're going to have to take a short break. We will be back in just a moment. Betty Andrews is with me, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP chapter and CEO of Betty Andrews Media, and Paula Moore, architectural historian at the State Historical Society of Iowa. More in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll preview two new documentaries premiering on Iowa Public Television this week. Right now, we're talking about the 20th Century Civil Rights Survey Project. It's an effort to collect history and nominations to preserve history of the civil rights movement in Iowa. Right now, there are 11 different sites that played an important role in African-American history in Iowa that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The State Historic Preservation Office is hoping to add sites to that list, or at least to a state list where we can share some of this important history. You are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me is Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP chapter and CEO of Betty Andrews Media. Paula Moore is here, architectural historian at the State Historical Society of Iowa and a certified local government coordinator. And Betty, I had to interrupt you for the break, but we were talking about the Edna Griffin Building in Des Moines, an important piece of Iowa history and our history in the civil rights movement. And getting that building designated, I mean, what do you think that means to Iowans?
You know, it is so significant. Number one, we're in Women's History Month also. So as a female, and she was a doctor's wife and came here from Kentucky. But the fact that she would take a stand in a time, and we're talking 1948. This incident happened July 7th, 1948. The fact that during that time that she would stand and not allow herself to be discriminated against is huge. That gives people hope. That allows people to think that, hey, I can accomplish this as well. And it also prevented a lot of Iowans from being mistreated and treated as second-class citizens. So while it was only $1, the significance of the ruling was huge for many people. And then also just the other thing is there was, and additionally, the owner of Cat's Diner actually did have to, he was prosecuted criminally, actually, and received a $50 fine. But, you know, we often talk about that $1, but $50 as well. So that impact is huge.
Well, and just the education to everyone who knew what happened and knew how it was decided. That was a big turning point.
Absolutely. And that stands now as a place where forever it is a reminder of that this great feat. And I think that's what, you know, we're seeing. And that's why these things are so important, as you know, Paula was saying, being able to document it and show that it did exist, that it did happen, that these champions for civil rights were there and they were quite powerful in the endeavors that they undertook.
Let's talk about another site. Paula, you want to talk about the Cooper House in Council Bluffs. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, this is a property that a local historian in Council Bluffs called in to us. And this is the home of George and O.C. Cooper. This house still stands. And both George and O.C. were involved in the local and state NAACP chapters. George actually established the Council Bluffs chapter in 1942. And then he later became president of the state chapter. And then his wife, O.C., had a leadership role in the state chapter as well, beginning in 1962. So it's really exciting to see that their house still survives, and it still pretty much looks the way it would have looked when the Coopers lived there.
We have a number of people already on the phones who want to share their stories. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And let's go to Johnny on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Johnny.
Hi, it's John.
Oh, okay. What would you like to talk about, John?
Oh, sorry. Well, I'm president of something called the Iowa Labor History Society. And one of the things that we've been trying to establish and document is the important role of the Iowa labor movement in the Iowa civil rights movement. So that takes, for example, Anna Mae Weems, who's a very well-known civil rights activist in Waterloo, but it's also really important to remember that she was a member of United Packing House Workers of America, Local 46, and their union hall still stands, or one of them anyway. And so in this effort to try to commemorate the history of the civil rights movement, it's also really important for us to be commemorating and documenting the history of the labor movement where those two things intersect. And, of course, that's not just a part of the past. For example, you have a large contingent of black steel workers in the Quad Cities who are doing, you know, wonderful work with regard to civil rights today, as well as the Teamsters in the state. And so there's a lot of places that might not be immediately come to mind, but that are very much living civil rights centers in Iowa.
Yeah, and Betty, it sounds like you wanted to react to that.
Yes, Charity. I'm really glad that he brought the connection between the labor unions and civil rights, because that is one of the places the areas in which the civil rights movement gained a lot of power, because union workers treated and had their minority members. They wanted them to be treated exactly the same. And so some of the things that the ways that African Americans and other minorities were able to overcome different scenarios at, adverse scenarios at work was the fact that the labor union bonded with them, and that gave them strength in numbers and people of all colors. And so that was hugely important. And the other thing I want to acknowledge is that I know and love Anna Mae Weems out of Waterloo, and she, she's probably 90 plus years old now, but she is such a energizer bunny. And not only in the labor union, I know the story well about how she was able to get so many African and American workers hired, but also just in the civil rights movement. I know that there's a district in Waterloo that it was like kind of like the Bottoms, and she brought Dr. Martin Luther King to that district. And so, and there's a story that she walked from church to try to get allow Dr. King for them to allow him to speak. And it was just really powerful to hear some of the activities that Miss Anna Mae Weems has been a part of. So absolutely, I'm sure that around her life, in addition to the labor piece that this gentleman mentioned, that there are a number of sites that she has connection to there.
Absolutely. John, thank you so much for bringing that up. Let's go now to Pam on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Pam.
Hi. My thing is not about current things, but it's about old ones. There was a white funeral home right where the Lucas Building is now that the state took down. And when I was in Campfire years ago, we took a tour of it and saw where it had been a part of the Underground Railroad between Des Moines and Albion, Iowa. And later on, my daughter lived in a house that we just didn't think it was quite right the way it was built, and found out later on, she did some research at the Marshall County Courthouse and found that it also had, because its basement had all these little extra rooms only accessible through really weird places, and it was a stop on the Underground Railroad between Des Moines and Albion. So I just wanted to turn those in.
Oh, absolutely. And as Paula mentioned earlier, suggesting on the website is a great idea. And also, Pam, I have to suggest that you get in touch with the Office of the State Archaeologist. They've done a lot of research about the Underground Railroad in Iowa, a lot of information coming to light just really in recent years. Paula, did you want to comment on that?
Well, in some ways, the current project to look at the civil rights movement is an outgrowth of a project that one of my colleagues in my office was working on, and that was to document sites related to the Underground Railroad in the 19th century. And so we do have a lot of information about what happened in the 1800s. Betty mentioned the Alexander Clark House in Muscatine. That's such a landmark associated with desegregation of Iowa schools. But we really saw this project, the Civil Rights Project, as an opportunity to move this into the 20th century. And I think one of the exciting things about this project is that we're really talking about the recent past. So in many ways, in many instances, we have an opportunity to talk to people who lived this history. Just a couple weeks ago, I had the opportunity to talk with Stanley Griffin. And Stanley is Edna Griffin's son. And he took us to the family house, which is on 44th Street here in Des Moines. And that house has a really interesting history because the Griffin family was not able to get a mortgage on the house because of the color of their skin. So they turned to a family friend who was white, and he got the mortgage. And then the Griffin family paid the friend a monthly payment every month. And so this was a workaround, unfair lending practices. The other thing that Stanley told us that I thought was really interesting is that the family moved into the house in the middle of the night so that they could move in under the
There's a history
darkness.
With African Americans. Yes. We often move in at night, and there's a reason. So, and that's actually, it stems in the thing that you're speaking about, people having concerns about the neighborhoods that they're moving into. Absolutely.
So we know a lot about Enda Griffin's advocacy and her public life, but that really, for me, added a new dimension to understand what was going on domestically.
Also really just underscores the kind of risks that people had to take to fight for equality and their rights. I mean, people were putting their lives on the line.
And keep in mind that Stanley Sr. and Edna's husband was a doctor. So these are people of means.
Wow. Well, the other point that Stanley the son made is that he wanted to be sure that we acknowledged the importance of his father, because his father was able to keep food on the table and didn't necessarily have to worry about losing his job because of his wife's advocacy. I thought that was very interesting.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about some of the other sites on your list. And Betty, I'll let you bring up another one. I would love to talk a little bit about the Black Panther movement in Des Moines and Iowa. I think this is a part of our history that not a lot of people know about. And there's a site on 12th Street in Des Moines that you'd like to talk about, right?
Well, there is a site on 12th Street. I'm not absolutely sure that it is on the list there, but I do want to acknowledge that the reason why it's not on the list is because the house was bombed. The Black Panther movement was a movement that was happening across the country, but specifically here in Iowa and Des Moines, there were a group of Black Panther members who were they were doing activities in terms of working with having breakfast clubs and a number of community activities, as well as Black Panthers definitely spoke out in favor of supporting the African American community. What's really interesting is that this location on 12th Street was bombed, and but even before that, there was a lot of concern and propaganda here in Iowa about Black Panthers and weapons and things like that. But a lot of people don't know that Black Panthers in Iowa had made a pact that they did not carry weapons, and so this house was bombed, and a lot of people think that law enforcement was responsible for that bombing. A lot of people, and law enforcement denies that. But what is interesting is that one of our state representatives, Kayo Abdul-Samad, was actually in the home when it was bombed. And I know people that live in that neighborhood yet today, and they speak about how that bomb knocked the windows out of the houses in the neighborhood. So it was a really huge event, a really huge explosion, and just a strong part of Iowa's history that is no longer present. Yeah. So I'm not sure how we're treating that on this project, but I think
it's important
really,
to talk
it
about.
It is really
sure.
important to talk about.
I think we have time for one more call. Bruce is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Bruce.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. This is a really interesting discussion. I would echo, I know about Anna Mae Weems, and she was a real dynamo in Local 56 United Packing House Workers. But I was calling about another space that is right in the area where the Black Panthers were active and near where they had their chapter headquarters on 12th Street, or near 12th and University, and that is Good Park. And Good Park is right there.
We just lost Bruce mid thought there. But so Good Park, is that a site that one of you is familiar with?
I am familiar with Good Park in the sense that that was a part of the neighborhood that I grew up near. And Good Park was, in, I know that there's a deeper history, but it certainly was a hub of the community, of the African-American community. They had pools and everything happened at Good Park in terms of outside activities. So I know that later we now have the Evelyn K. Davis Park in that same general area. And that's also a significant area. I attended Tiny Tot in that area prior to it being turned into the park. So
nice.
Yes.
All right. We only have a couple of minutes left and so many other stories that I would love to have a chance to talk with you both about. Let's just slip one more story in here. Paula, Everhart's Music Store in Red Oak. Tell me very briefly about the music store.
Yes. Well, you wouldn't think that there would be a property in a relatively small town in southwest Iowa, but this, I think, is just a great example of how deep this history goes. So Mr. Everhart had a music store in downtown Red Oak, and he got his supply of pianos, his musical instruments, from a company in Chicago. And at some point, they realized that he was Black. And so they refused after that to send him any more pianos to sell. So he sued, and he won his court case. And so that building still stands.
Fascinating.
In Red Oak.
Well, there are so many stories that we could talk about. And I know you want to encourage people all over the state to share their stories. Betty, just in 30 seconds left, having this project organized, having people finding out about these sites, what does that mean to us, do you think?
Well, I think it is a lesson for many people who want to discriminate. One of the things, and just want to touch on this, it's so interesting that a number of these sites are sites because at that site, maybe the owners and things like that, like in the case of Cat's drugstore, wanted to discriminate. And now, historically, that building that they used as a tool of hate actually is now a tool of history for the civil rights movement. So it's a lesson to many people to say, okay, you better be careful how you use your site.
Betty
because
Andrews,
this can change.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And Paula Moore, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the 20th Century Civil Rights Survey Project. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's March, and that means it's festival time on Iowa Public Television. Now, of course, that means fundraising, but it also means that it's time for the premiere of some exciting new programs. We're going to preview two programs premiering this week, and I do need to disclose that Iowa Public Television is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio. I also do a little work for IPTV myself. In a few minutes, we'll find out about the new IPTV production, Iowa Land and Sky. But first, The Happiness Machine is a documentary about Carl Hayes and the way he's chosen to live his life on 22 acres of land in Dallas County near Adel. Here's a moment from the documentary.
I live on the promised land. The promised land is 22 acres of the great Iowa soil that I came to own when it was nothing but timber and farmland. And over a period of many years, I brought it from that to what was a dream, and which I have come to call idyllical, an independent, do-it-yourself, low-consumption, agrarian lifestyle. This is living happily ever after.
That's just a moment from the documentary The Happiness Machine from director Rebecca Bloomhagen that debuts on Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m. on Iowa Public Television. And Carl Hayes, the subject of the documentary, is here with me now. Hello, Carl.
Well, hello there, Charity.
Thank you for being here. And Carl, you gave us a little snippet of your personal philosophy there, but I want to take a moment to talk about the land that you lived on, that you do live on. This is where you grow up as well?
Yes. It's part of the land of where I grew up. That's correct.
And your father gave you an important lesson about this land when you were a child. Tell me about that.
Yes, well, my father was a sharecropper during my early childhood, and he, of course, always wanted to own Iowa land. And finally, when I was about 12 years old, he bought 8 acres of land. It's the first land that he had owned. And he and I were alone when he first walked onto that piece of property. And when we got there, he stopped at the gate. And as we opened the gate, he stopped to have a little ceremony, which was to share with me what he thought was the great blessing of owning land. And there's more about that in the film, but that I was quite impressed. It stayed with me for my whole life.
And although you grew up on this land, you went on to do what so many of us do. You went to school, you had a career. What brought you back to the land?
Well, I never forgot it, really. I traveled far and wide, but I kept thinking to myself, you know, one day I'd like to go back to Iowa, too, and live on the beautiful land, as it were. And it just so happened that eventually I got the opportunity to do that.
You are described in several different ways in information about this documentary as an inventor, as a tinkerer, but you have built your home on this land and really come up with, you do so much with your hands. Tell me a little bit about what you do with your property.
Well, everything that's been done here essentially we have done. It was completely cleaned of buildings or any other development when we started. So we built roads, and of course we built the house and the other outbuildings that are here, and have cleared timber, harvested timber, and of course we grow about a few acres of hay crop to sell. But all of these activities require an enormous amount of making things that will act as tools of one sort or another. And so it, as it turns out, the entire experience has been mostly an exercise in things to make and do. And the fortunate thing was that I brought a lot of those skills with me.
And clearly, you love living this way. For people who are going to be watching this documentary, I know a lot of people will be fantasizing about, you know, if I could get away from it all and live this kind of life in a rural area. But most of us can't do that. But what lessons do you think all of us can take away from the happiness you and your wife have found living this way?
Well, I don't hold my experience or our experience up as a model for anyone, because you're quite right. There are a lot of reasons why people can't do this. However, my hope is that by watching the film, you will be inspired to think about what led us here and how we lived after we got here. This doesn't have to be an agrarian lifestyle in order to share some of the benefits of it. So I do hope not to mislead anyone to trying to do this without really thinking about it a long time first. I had many benefits that others don't have. For the skills are one example, but the chance to buy the land at the time that I was young enough to to do all of this and not too old to enjoy it. And I'm just hoping that others will find some inspiration for their own lives. I do want to explain one thing about independent, which is the first of those long line of words. Independent does not mean free from other people or the things around it. What independence refers to is making choices, thinking about your choices. Do I really want this? Can I really do this? Is this fair to the people around me? And so on and so on. And everybody can do that. And I'm hoping that some of the choices we made will encourage others, but not necessarily to do exactly what we have done.
The name of the documentary is The Happiness Machine, and that comes from one of your inventions, one of the things you've put together with your hands. Tell me about your happiness machine.
Well, a happiness machine is essentially an electrical ice cream freezer, what was a hand-turned ice cream freezer. And many years ago when my children were young, I wanted to carry on the family tradition of making homemade ice cream. And, of course, they didn't want to turn. They wanted to eat, but they didn't want to turn.
Like all of us.
So I got this grand idea of turning a bicycle upside down to power it. And once it did that successfully, I thought, well, what greater happiness? So it became the happiness machine. And it's also named after a story in a book called Dandelion Wine, which has a story of another happiness machine that's always been impressive for me. So that's how we got the happiness machine.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too. Carl Hayes, he is the subject of a new documentary called The Happiness Machine about his life on his 22 acres of land in Dallas County, and it debuts on Iowa Public Television tomorrow evening. We're going to talk now about something that's debuting on Iowa Public Television tonight at 6:30. It's Iowa Land and Sky. It's a natural history lesson and a love letter to our beautiful state. It features stunning aerial videography as well as close-up on-the-ground camera work. Let's listen to just a moment from Iowa Land and Sky.
Along the western rim of Iowa, an early spring ritual begins. These hills of windblown silt, built by an accumulation over millennia, are set for human intervention by a team of trained firefighters. The prairie grasses that coat the Luss Hills are about to be set ablaze. The brown grass of early spring is turned black, but a rejuvenation of the Luss Prairie is just beginning. The controlled burn helps reduce invasive species, restore nutrients to the soil, and boost the coming summer, all to help the Luss Hills turn from brown to black and eventually to explode again with life.
That's just a moment from Iowa Land and Sky, and with me is executive producer Andrew Bott. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And of course, Iowa Land and Sky, it's debuting this week on Iowa Public Television. But you have been sharing these videos as a web series starting last fall. Tell me a little bit about the concept for the project.
Well, it started about 2 years ago when we wanted to show our state from a different perspective, in part on the ground, but a lot of it aerially using aerial drones. And we thought that we could give Iowans a different view of the landforms, landscapes, their towns, and in this documentary, even some of the cultural events that we know that are uniquely Iowan. And we wanted to incorporate it into a general audience documentary, which is premiering tonight. But we also incorporated many of the educational resources IPTV has to use these tools. And in the clip you just ran, for example, in the Luss Hills, we spent a lot of planning to fly over a very large prairie burn throughout the Luss Hills and then show that process of the rejuvenation over months, taking those drones back in and flying over and seeing the prairie rejuvenate.
And the videography in this series is really stunning. Did this grow out of getting a new toy for cameramen to use?
Well, to keep a theme going, I think the ice cream machine was a happiness machine there. These drones at times were a happiness machine for us because they allowed us to see our state from a different perspective. But we had some people on our staff that had experience in drones, and they advised us this takes time. It's not like flying in other states. They've used helicopters to fly across the state. You're further up, and they zip around the state in a matter of days. Drones take more time. They take time. They take training. You need to be safe about it. So it took 2 years of training, doing this legally, and to be able to be in all these places across the state, sometimes at that perfect sunset moment on the Les Hills or at sunrise on the Mississippi River in Lansing or down at Keokuk. So it took time.
Absolutely. And you've incorporated a number of these shots into other projects at Iowa Public Television. But I mean, this is such a showcase for this kind of photography, but also just for how incredibly beautiful our state is. It must be so much fun to edit these pieces together and really see how stunning they are.
It is. And there's so much footage we've shot. You've got to boil it all down. And what viewers and Iowans are going to see tonight is the best of the best across the entire state. We spend time on the western rim of Iowa, as you use that clip, during a prairie burn. We show you everywhere up from Okoboji to down south near Council Bluffs in southwest Iowa. We go across central Iowa. We have some very unique perspectives at the state capitol here in Des Moines. We flew over the state fair during the state fair. So we also incorporated some cultural events like that and down in Pella during the Pella Tulip Festival. So it's landscapes, it's towns, and it's something that I think when Iowans see it, they'll be very proud of their state.
Let's talk about some of the specific experiences you've had. One at the Kate Shelley High Bridge near Boone. Tell me about shooting there.
Yeah, we had this great idea to go to the Kate Shelley High Bridge in a snowstorm and fly a drone. It actually worked out really well. We didn't know. It happened to be a dry kind of snow. It was very cold. And the aerial drones we used were very robust. They fly up at speeds as high as 55, 60 miles an hour with a tailwind. And it was a unique experience. And it's something Iowans will see tonight, that it kind of creates a sense of mood and history there. There's two bridges there now, but the Kate Shelley Bridge has a long history, dating back more than 100 years. And it's just a great view of something that maybe a lot of Iowans may have seen, but they've never seen like this.
And it sounds like an intense experience filming as well. Does it get a little scary sometimes?
It does. It really, really, really does. At times, you know, we didn't have any major accidents in the process of this, but you are flying an object with a camera on it at 50 miles an hour around a lot of different places and locations. And, you know, over time, we got more used to it. But there are some hair-raising times, especially when we were dealing with wildlife.
I'm sure. Well, you have used a lot of this in conjunction with the Raptor Resource Project in on the Mississippi River. And we've seen some wonderful footage of the Decorah Eagles. But you were using this drone technology with peregrine falcons?
Yes. So this is one of the ideas when we first started. You have a lot of ideas of how you want to use technology. You never know if time, resources, weather is going to work out. But the great folks at the Raptor Resource Project, where many Iowans see their work this week with eagles on eaglet eggs in Decorah, they also do a lot of work with peregrine falcons along the upper Mississippi. It's a long-term project their original founder, Bob Anderson, created. We wanted to be able to show those beautiful bluffs and see that process of them climbing down the bluffs. Well, when they do that, and this team is very trained. They've done it for decades. They're so experienced. They know how to do this carefully and get approval from the Fish and Wildlife Service. The X factor is on this was flying an aerial drone, which are loud and could be maybe interpreted as a predator around the mother peregrine falcons in that situation. So we had a lot of people watching that, trying to see, as I was nervous about it a little bit, because they said, we just don't know how they're going to react if the peregrines, which are the fastest animals on the planet, would descend and attack the drone. Obviously, we did not want that to happen, and that's not what happened. We got some amazing images from that process, but it was hair-raising.
I'm sure. And you've also featured a few of the quirky spots around the state of Iowa, the highest point, mm-hmm. Snake Alley, which is everyone should go there, but it's great to see it from an aerial view as well. What was filming in Snake Alley like?
It was neat. You know, I've worked in Iowa Public Television for 15 years. There are places I got to go on this that I haven't ever seen. And Snake Alley happened to be one of them. I just haven't been there before. And I happened to be able to go and get a really great perspective when you get up 100 feet and can look right down at how that winds through
Burlington.
That path. Yeah, and Burlington, and see Burlington in a way that that's really beautiful.
Well, Andrew Bott, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Charity.
Andrew Bott is the executive producer of Iowa Land and Sky. It is a web series. You can find it online, but also the hour-long documentary will premiere tonight on Iowa Public Television at 6:30. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.